So you can turn to Ruth chapter 4, have that open in front of you. This is going to be our last time in Ruth for about 20 years. No, I'm just saying. Just feel like that every time we come to an end of a book. Next week, we're not going to be starting Acts quite yet. We're going to have a 1 week break while I get my head at the end of some books that I'm reading, so that we're ready for Acts in 2 weeks' time. And that will also give you an opportunity to get into it. If you haven't got one of these already, these are free. They're outside on the table. You can have one each. You don't have to share them in your couples or anything, if you're married. You can have one each, and they're out there. Please do get into that. There are 50 undated studies in Acts, and it'd just be a really great introduction and probably help you and help me as we begin to look at Acts together. So let's turn back to Ruth, and you should have an outline. And my title is unashamedly stolen from a very famous Christian book, Redemption Accomplished and Applied. Get hold of it. It's great. Anyway, I just thought it was relevant for today's passage. Now, as we look out on the world, if you're into the news, you can't really escape the headlines, can you? And people, it seems, are constantly jostling for power in our world. Now, it might be something trivial, like the Premiership title, for example. I'm not saying that is trivial. If you're into football, that's great. But it is relatively trivial when you consider the likes of Donald Trump flexing his muscles on the global stage. Or accusations against Theresa May for using Brexit to increase her majority, to increase her power. We talked about independence from Europe a bit of time, haven't we? So we can take control. We want to be in power. And then we look at people like North Korea, testing nuclear weapons. And we kind of look out in the world and we see these people flexing their muscles. Who's really in charge? Who is the boss? Everyone's vying for that role, aren't they, of being the ultimate mover and shaker. And if we were without God, we might look out on the world and wonder who really is in charge. Is there anyone really in charge? Or are we just going to end up blowing each other up? Is that really what's going to happen? Is there anyone who's going to stop that? Is there any hope for anything different? Well, in light of all that, I think the Book of Ruth is really helpful. It's one of great assurance. It's one of great comfort for certain people. It's great comfort for those who take shadow under the wings of God. Because God is the king. That's what we've been seeing. You see, the book of Ruth was set in the time of Judges, a very dark time, if you remember, where people had moved away from God, when there was no king, when everyone did what was right in their own eyes. But this book shows us that there is a king. There is a king who's committed to bringing about his purposes on this earth through a people and in a family. That's the great news that we can hold on to. Now, one big theme in Ruth is redemption, and we've already thought a bit about that this morning. But chapter 4 is the great redemption chapter, really, in Ruth. It comes, the word in various forms, comes like 15 times in these 22 verses, mostly in the first half. This is undeniably a chapter about redemption. In chapter 2, when Naomi hears of Boaz, she says, he is one of our guardian redeemers. In chapter 3, as we saw last week, Naomi and Ruth sought redemption. They were looking for it, and actually redemption was promised and pledged by Boaz. But chapter 3, if you remember, ended on a kind of slight tension, a bit of a cliffhanger. You see, what we didn't know at the end of chapter 3 was who actually would this redeemer be? Who was it going to be? Was it going to be this other closer redeemer, or was it going to be Boaz? Would Boaz manage to get it? That was the question at the end of chapter 3. And also, how would redemption come about? These two questions, who would the redeemer be? How would redemption come about? Are what our chapter really answers those questions. But it also tells us something else. Not only how redemption will be accomplished, but how it would be applied. How the redemption of this family led to the provision of a king for the nation and of a saviour for the world. That's our theme this morning. And this chapter has two scenes. We might call it at the gate and at home, at the home. And then it ends with a little short genealogy. So let's have a think about at the gate. To start with, redemption accomplished, the first 12 verses. And these really kind of are broken down into three other parts. You see, we see redemption completed. We see it kind of transacted, if you like. We see it witnessed, and we see it blessed. You see, the redemption completed is from the first part. And I think here the writer is drawing our attention particularly to the character of the Redeemer. What does the Redeemer look like? What are they like? And this comes out really clearly when we consider this unnamed Redeemer. You see, this unnamed Redeemer is a bit like a foil. Someone who shows us by his very opposite what the Redeemer is like. You see, the way that Boaz addresses this man when he sees him is really interesting. Our translation, it probably has something like friend. So in at the end of verse 1, come over here, my friend, and sit down. And it's a really interesting phrase in the Hebrew, which is basically two words, which means something like someone of a certain one. So he says, hi, someone of a certain one, come over here and sit down. We might think so-and-so, or, you know, when we talk about places, we're not really that bothered what the name of the place is. You might say such-and-such place, or this is such-and-such place, and it's all so-and-so, and they say, and it's that kind of idea. He's unnamed. But this is really striking in a chapter full of names, isn't it? But here is a key character, we might have thought, but he remains unnamed. I'm going to call him Mr. So-and-so as we go through. Because he's unnamed for a reason. His anonymity brings out better things, you see, in the life of Boaz, in his character. We'll see Boaz as a proactive, a wise, and as a generous redeemer. First of all, he's proactive, isn't he? He's clearly calling the shots now, you see. Chapter 3, verse 15, Boaz left the stage, which was the threshing floor at that point, and we focused on Ruth's return to Naomi. But now chapter 4 goes back and follows the movements of Boaz. Meanwhile, we're told, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. See, he wastes no time, does he? As Naomi predicted, at the end of chapter 3, the man will not rest until the matter is settled today, and how right she is. And the town gate was the place where people would go in and out of the city, but it was also the place where a business was conducted. So Boaz would sit down early by the town gate, and not only would he catch his man as he went out to the fields, but it's the place where he could do business with the man he was wanting. And along he comes. Boaz said, come over here, Mr. So-and-so, and sit down. So we went over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here. And they did so. You see, Boaz is kind of calling the shots. He's organizing everything to make his plan happen. In the last chapter, we saw it's Naomi who was kind of planning and kind of scheming, not in the wrong way, but just, you know, that was what she was doing. She was using all the wisdom she had, all the knowledge she had, to put a plan into place. And now Boaz is doing the same here. So he's proactive. He's also very wise, isn't he? He knows how it works. He knows how to make this work. Verse 3, he says to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. Now, just a word of explanation, I hope, here, because you may be thinking, if you were here last week, well, hang on, how did that work? You know, how does Boaz know that Naomi wants to sell a piece of land when Ruth was clearly asking him to, you know, consider marrying her? I mean, where did land come in at all last week? And how does he kind of know? Well, I think we need to remember, don't we, that when Ruth presented herself to Boaz last week, said, Boaz, I'm kind of open to marriage. She appealed to him, if you remember, as a redeemer. Now, in the Old Testament, there was no requirement or necessarily duty spelled out for a redeemer to marry. It wasn't really, that wasn't spelled out in the Old Testament. So actually, what she was saying was that marriage was within the kind of scope of a redeemer, even though it wasn't kind of spelled out, if that makes sense. What is spelled out, though, is the idea of redeeming land and people. And so I take it that when she appealed to him as her redeemer, he knew that actually she meant, it's me and all my possessions, including the land, that are part of the deal. So having established that, verse 4, he says, I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Now again, if you're reading this for the first time, and you've kind of seen the character of Boaz, and you're kind of really willing Boaz and Ruth to kind of get together, you might have a kind of think, oh, he's blown it. Boaz has kind of blown it, hasn't he? He's thrown it all away. The plan seems to have failed. He seems to have miscalculated. But of course he hasn't, has he? He's wise in his dealings. He knows what it works, what works. And at that point, he explains what we might call a sting in the tail for Mr. So-and-so. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. And there's something about this sting in the tail that surprises Mr. So-and-so, something he hadn't realized. At this, the guardian redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. So wise old Boaz knows how it all works and comes up trumps in the good sense of the word. And then thirdly, we see a generous Boaz. Now, at this point, you see in the story, we might have several questions. Well, I certainly did as I was reading it, and so I'm assuming that someone out here might have some other questions. You know, what was it that changed Mr. So-and-so's mind? You know, did he not really realise that he was going to have to marry someone? What was so surprising about Boaz's kind of follow-up comment? You see, on the one hand, you might have thought if marriage was an expected part of the deal, he'd have known about it and wouldn't have been surprised, and therefore would have said yes, knowing full well what that meant. On the other hand, if it weren't part of the deal, he could have objected surely and said, oh, come on, Boaz, you can't lay that one on me. You know, I'm not, you know, that isn't part of the deal. He doesn't do that either. And the elders don't have a problem with it either, do they? So what is going on here? Well, one possible explanation is this, that perhaps Mr. So-and-so was expecting to take on a widow, but the widow he was expecting to take on was Naomi. Now, for a man who takes on an old widow, you know, she may not live that much longer. She isn't going to be that hard to maintain, and after it, he gets a field. You know, that's a bonus, isn't it? But actually, if it's Ruth that he's taking on, here's a young lady, younger lady. She might have lots of children. She's going to be really expensive. I'm going to lose my land to the heir. You can see, can't you, that that would bring a kind of sting in the tail for him. Kind of a surprise that he hadn't really kind of got hold of. Now, that was obviously one possible reconstruction of that, and I think it's got some merit to it. Another factor might, in his kind of deciding a change of heart, might be Ruth's ethnic origin. It's interesting, isn't it, that Boaz brings that back in at this point. Ruth of the Moabite, he wants to remind him. So perhaps Mr. So-and-so is worried for his reputation too. Well, whatever it is, he's certainly unwilling, isn't he, to do it. And it seems to be because of the cost, whether it's financial or a cost to his reputation. He's unwilling to set aside his own interests in order to help another, even one of his own family. And in fact, he even gives that excuse, doesn't he? If this is a genuine excuse, I might endanger my own estate. But all of that, you see, goes to highlight something else, doesn't it? The generosity of Boaz. You see, Mr. So-and-so is a foil, a negative image, if you like, of the positive, which is Boaz. See, rather than being concerned for his own self, for his self-preservation, he gives of himself for the sake of another. He gave of himself in order to maintain, it says, the name of the dead with his property. If Boaz didn't intervene, then after Naomi died, there would be a parcel of land in Israel that would have no owner. And there would be a family in Israel whose name would be wiped out. So Boaz gives of himself. He gives what costs. And he does that in order to redeem it for someone else. Now, we're not going to comment much on verse 7 and 8 this morning, feet and sandals and that kind of stuff. But just to say that I think it makes sense that feet, according to one commentator, feet and shoes in the Old Testament often symbolized power. So this custom, you could see, would signal a transfer of power and possession to someone else. You might be aware of a passage in the Old Testament where it's kind of seen as a curse, where someone refuses to carry out their duty of a redeemer, and the woman comes along and takes off someone else's shoe and gives it, or slaps him in the face or something with it, yeah? And that would make sense, wouldn't it? Because someone else is taking away the power from that person. But here, he takes off his own sandal and his own shoe and hands over power and possession to Boaz. It's his right now to redeem. So, we have Mr. So-and-so shows us how great Boaz is. He's a proactive, wise, and generous redeemer. Now, I don't want to make, kind of glib references to Jesus at this point, but you can see, can't you, that this is what was required of a redeemer. A redeemer had to be someone who did it, who was proactive in bringing about redemption. They had to be someone who was wise and someone who was generous, even to the expense of his own self. And surely we can see here, can't we, a picture of Jesus, who's called our Redeemer, who took the initiative, who we are told died for us whilst we were still sinners. Nobody was waving, sticking their hand up, saying, oh, please come and save me, Jesus. But he did. He proactively. It was all part of the plan of God. And he was wise. I mean, the plan worked. Even though at one point it would have looked like Jesus had thrown it all away. He'd allowed himself to be nailed on a cross. He'd allowed himself to be mocked by many. It seemed like it had all been thrown away. But actually, that was God's means of bringing about redemption. And today, the cross is still foolishness to the world, isn't it? It's still a foolish plan in the eyes of the world. But actually, it's the power of God for the salvation of sinners. God is proactive in sending Jesus. He's wise and he's generous, isn't he? Who laid down his own life that he might maintain our names, if you like. Isn't this a great picture of the redemption that Jesus has brought? That's redemption completed. We also see, more briefly, witnessed and then blessed. Have a look at verse 9. And Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have brought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's wife, widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses." Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses." Witnesses, witnesses, witnesses. And we can see in this kind of section the purpose of redemption really reiterated, can't we? See, in verse 5, you know, what was the point of redemption? Why was that ever a thing that was put in God's law? Well, it was there to maintain the name of the dead with his property. And as Boaz tells us here, it's so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Now, we all know what witnesses are. So that if I want to get a passport, I have to have someone who comes along and signs on the back of my photo. You know, this is a true likeness. Or if you're having a mortgage done or something, you've got to sign something important. You know, somebody else has got to sign to say, yeah, this person actually signed it and I saw them sign it. So that at some point in the future, if there was ever a problem, a dispute, they could be called upon to verify what had happened. Well, that's what the role of these witnesses were, to verify that redemption was complete and secure. Nothing could change it. It was permanent. It had been witnessed to. And there's that's a wonderful thing, isn't it, that our redemption in Jesus too is permanent. It's been witnessed, it's been stamped, it's complete, and it's secure. Our names too are safe. We're not tied up with a piece of land in this world, but our names are tied, aren't they, as it were, to the land that is coming, to the future, the heavenly rest, the heavenly land. Our names are written in the book of the Lamb of God and cannot be erased. And that's, we can have great confidence in Jesus our Redeemer, that it will happen, that it will come to pass, that nothing can take us out of his hands or blot our names out of his book. And we see redemption blessed. We see the effect of this redemption, you see. Verse 11, may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Now, whatever else this blessing is saying, it's a blessing, it's a wish for fruitfulness and for fame and for kind of almost a new foundation. Fruitfulness, fame, and foundation. Rachel and Leah, you see, could be called the founding mothers of Israel. Between them and their concubines, they had the 12 sons of Jacob, who became the 12 tribes of Israel. They're praying for fruitfulness. They're wishing that Ruth would be equally prolific in her, bearing children for Boaz. They're also wishing fame and fortune for Boaz as the Redeemer. Now, we might think today that actually the more children have, the worse off you are. But actually in those days, the more children you had, the more productive you could be, and the greater your wealth, and the greater your security. Wow. Brilliant. Maybe we should, get some fields and stuff. Anyway, the point is they're wishing through this prolific wife, this kind of childbearing wife, fame and riches and wealth and fortune for Boaz, the Redeemer. And then we come on to Perez. Now, Perez was the clan that Boaz and probably most of the people there belonged to. And that's why they've mentioned it. Probably Perez is in their minds the kind of almost the founding father of their community, of the people that they're a part of. And Perez, you may remember, was born to Judah and to Tamar. Now, there's a story. Tamar, not being Judah's wife, but his daughter-in-law. Go and read that, Genesis 38. Won't go through it all now, but just to summarise, there are some similarities between Tamar and Ruth in some ways. You say Tamar is a foreign woman. She is a foreign woman whose actions are judged to be kind of righteous, and whose actions save a family line threatened with extinction. A a family which becomes Judah's leading house. And Tamar gained fame in Israel because of it. And this is the wish that Ruth too might have that same experience. You see, redemption has a kind of cascading effect, doesn't it? Redemption kind of like works its way out over time in the lives of many. I was thinking about, you know, often, I know we're having to make some choices and vote again, aren't we, after 2 years? And I'm thinking, right, what's happened in 2 years? You know, what policies actually flow through that we can see the fruit of after 2 years of politics? I'm not sure. Maybe there are some. Unless you're Donald Trump, nothing happens immediately, does it? You know, things take a while to kind of flow through and to cascade down. And it's the same with redemption. Redemption has like a cascading effect. See, it doesn't just bless Naomi. It actually spreads out and cascades down. And it blesses the whole of the nation. And when you think about it, isn't that what happens to the redemption that's provided in Jesus? You see, Jesus wasn't just a baby to sort out Mary and Joseph. It wasn't even a baby just for Bethlehem or even for Israel. Jesus was a baby whose redemption was to bless the whole world. See, even foreigners like Ruth and Tamar were included in it. And the redemption of Jesus would be the foundation, wouldn't it, for the family of God's people from every nation without distinction. So, redemption has been accomplished. And now, redemption will see it's been applied, how it flowed through to others. Now, verse 13 moves the story on pretty quickly. So, Boaz took Ruth, she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And as one commentator puts it, whereas 70 verses describe a few months' event, here 15 words. If you've got a Hebrew Bible, it's 15 words. NIV is 28, but 15 words in Hebrew covers 9 months. So clearly, the actual birth narrative is not that important in the story. I mean, it is, obviously, but it's you know, 9 months in 15 words. See, and with this verse, Ruth and Boaz kind of move off the scene a bit. And this helps us, I think, to understand what the main purpose of Ruth is. See, many people, and it's, you know, is a great story. Many people think of Ruth as a kind of romantic love story between a destitute foreign woman and a generous, a kind-hearted, handsome prince, perhaps a little bit like a Cinderella story. And it is, obviously, that does feature. But actually, it's a book more about God, isn't it? It's a book about what the Lord has been doing. It's about how the Lord has provided Naomi with a redeemer, a nation with a king, and a world with a saviour. That's what Ruth is about. And here we learn that despite very kind of ordinary circumstances, marriage, childbirth, you know, the Lord is behind it all. In verse 13 it says, the Lord enabled her to conceive. She spent 10 years in Moab and married to Mahlon, presumably unable to conceive, no child to show for it. And so the Lord intervenes. This is the book about the Lord, about how he has brought everything about. Firstly, he brings a redeemer for a family. Look at verse 14. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He'll renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than 7 sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, it might be that you've read that or listened to that and you're now a little bit confused. And maybe you're not. I don't want to cause you confusion. But just now, we were told that Boaz was the redeemer, right? As in, he's the redeemer. So how come now, in verse 14, these women are calling him, the baby, the guardian redeemer? Let me just kind of This is not 100% clear, but let me just kind of show you what might be happening here. See, it's possible that in verse 14, some women have been at Ruth and Boaz's house. The birth has happened. They rush to Naomi's house with the news of the birth, carrying the baby, and they bless her. And verse 16, Naomi takes the baby, and then she becomes his nurse. That's what it says in the Hebrew. It doesn't say she cared for her, although that's what obviously she was doing, but she became his nurse. So in a sense, this baby that had been born to Ruth and to Boaz became hers in some way. Now, there are some questions, aren't there? How come this baby is called the Redeemer? I thought that was Boaz's job. Whose baby is it anyway? How does that work? You know, what does it look like practically? And maybe you've got lots more questions. Well, those are the ones I came up with. Now, it does sound like, doesn't it, that this baby was given to Naomi, almost as a substitute son, in place of Mahlon and Chilion. This baby is the one, you see, who will end up carrying on Elimelech's name, and he would inherit his property. And the women declare as much. Naomi has a son. And this son clearly was to have a special relationship with Naomi. She becomes his nurse. He is going to look after her as she gets older. So in a sense, she does have a son. But it's also clear that the baby doesn't cease to become the son of Ruth and Boaz, doesn't it? And that's also equally clear. See, the best blessing in 12 anticipates that any offspring of hers will belong to them, not to Naomi. And when we look at the genealogy, we'll see it's Boaz who's mentioned, not Elimelech. So he has a kind of a dual parentage, if you like, a dual kind of thing going on here. He's the son of Ruth and Boaz, the heir of Boaz, but also the son of Naomi in some way. So the Lord has provided a redeemer for a family. He's solved her problem. This destitute, poor widow now had someone who would help her in her old age. He's redeemed a family. But he's also at the same time, and this is the amazing thing, at the same time, through the same event, he has provided a king for a nation. See, look at the genealogy, 17b. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then we get the fuller genealogy, the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David. Now if you were going to tell a really great story, and it was a love story, a romantic story between two people, why on earth would you have a genealogy at the end? You know what I mean? As in, like, what does that add to the romance? Well, it doesn't, does it? I think it helps us, doesn't it, to see that actually this is the point of the book. The point of the book is to show us the purpose, is to show us, and the original hearers, that David, you see, was no ordinary king. David was a king who had been divinely appointed. God's working through his history to bring him into existence proves that, this kind of remarkable working through all this kind of stuff, through famine and childlessness and all these other things that happen in this line. God has brought this about. God has done it. God has provided a king for his nation. Now, if you were, if you had David as your king, and maybe you were kind of slightly unsure as to whether he deserved your allegiance, well, here is proof and evidence that God has brought this about. This is someone that you need. This is God's anointed, the one that God has brought into being. Give your allegiance to him. But reading Ruth through the lens of the New Testament, we can't end there, can we? Because the genealogy continues, doesn't it? The story goes on. It's repeated for us in the New Testament, in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 1. He tells us this. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David. And then he goes through the same list. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Jacob, Judah. Judah's father of Perez. whose mother was Tamar, Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram, Ram, Amminadab, and so on and so on. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And then goes on and on. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called Messiah. See, at the same time, through the same event, God provided a redeemer for a family, a king for a nation, and a Messiah, a savior for the world. Our ultimate redeemer king, one who would provide redemption for all who would take refuge in him through his death on the cross. Now, I think this book is extremely encouraging. You know, God is at work in a world which looks like someone else's king. But actually, we know the truth. Elimelech, my God, is king. Isn't that true? That's where we started. Elimelech, my God, is king. God is king. God is doing it all. We look at the news, we look at the world around us. We think everyone else is looking like their king. But actually, God is a king. God is the one who could provide redemption through this situation. God is at work in the world today. And he uses the faithfulness of individual people, the crises of families. He uses all that kind of stuff to bring about his purposes in the world. Who knows what you're going to be facing this week? Who knows what you'll be facing as an individual, as a family this week? Who knows what we as a church will be facing, the challenges we'll be facing? One thing we can know is Elimelech, my God is king. And actually, my God is king, and he's bringing everything to pass in accordance with his purposes, even through us, through our faithfulness, through the faithfulness of his people, he is bringing about his plans in the world. And the question that this book begs us to answer is this: is the God who is king your God? Is he your? Is this God who is king your God? Will you take shelter under his wings? Will you take shelter under his wings, which are the gospel of Jesus Christ? You know, there is no safe place in this world apart from under the wings of God. Apart from being in the purposes of God, there is no safe place in this world. God is faithful. What he has said, he will do. We take refuge under his wings by believing the gospel, the good news that Jesus' death on the cross has redeemed a people for God. Jesus' proactive, only wise, generous outpouring of his life has provided redemption that is eternal. And the offer is universal. It's for all who come to him. Even foreigners can find refuge under the wings of God and find favor and become family. You see, no matter who is flexing their muscles on the world stage this week when we open our newspapers, we can say that our God is king.